Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we'll be exploring the risks around cataract surgery. Cataract surgery is one of the most commonly performed elective surgeries globally. In fact, over 400,000 procedures are done every year in England alone. The surgery is also one of the most successful in modern medicine, with increasingly higher patient and surgeon outcome expectations. Complications can still occur though, and with optometrists becoming ever more involved with cataract surgery patient pathways, from direct referral right through to post-operative care, we think it's worth exploring more on this podcast. My guest today is David Lockington. David is a consultant ophthalmologist and a cornea and cataract surgeon in Glasgow, Scotland. In my own clinical practice, I often manage patients before and after their cataract surgery, so it is a procedure that I am familiar with. But I wanted to talk to David about what surgeons are concerned about and how optometrists can be even more helpful throughout every stage. David, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So, David, to begin with, why is it so important for optometrists to have an understanding of the potential risks of cataract surgery?
Well, the optometrist is now, particularly in Scotland, the primary point of care for any eye problem. So they're the ones who are making the vast majority of referrals into the eye services for surgery. And so it makes sense if you're going to refer someone for surgery, you're going to have at least a basic understanding of what that would involve, what are the risks, so the patient can decide if it's for them or not at this stage. And that surely will mean that the referral pathway will be refined and more people will be not converted to surgery, but actually there for the right reasons.
Yes, and I think it's very easy for patients to become complacent because cataract surgery is so very successful, isn't it?
I think we've actually shot ourselves in the foot because it is so successful that everybody thinks it's like cutting your toenails. It's a quick and easy, clean operation. And the vast majority of times it is. It's fantastic to hear that the complication rate has halved again in the latest NOD database. But there's still risks. And for the individual patient, those risks can be quite significant. And so I think it's important to understand what is a visually significant cataract, which is affecting the patient's life. And then you can understand the benefits of the surgery and the risks can be interpreted within that context.
I'm just going to refer back to the National Outcomes Database because not everybody knows what that is. But it is great to see that the complication rates have come down. And I think because the rates are so low, patients feel they can be referred quite quickly as and when the cataract affects them. But actually, they need to be thinking over the long term, really, don't they? They need to think about when the cataract is starting to affect them rather than leaving it to the last minute. Because obviously, if you leave it to the last minute, potentially, the referral may not happen instantly. Depending on where you live in the UK, you may not be able to be referred within the timescale that you want to be. And the more developed a cataract is, the more mature it is, the greater the risk of complications.
Yes, historically, a cataract had to be ripe, but that was due to the method of extraction. Now, with modern technology and good training, it's actually safer to remove a cataract earlier because it's going to be less traumatic for the other delicate intraocular structures. But what that means is everybody's hearing how easy cataract surgery is. They're being done earlier. But what it means for the individual patient is they think, oh, I can just get this done. It's a breeze. But we still just have to be cautious, not just in the complex cases, but in patients who maybe don't have as much visual symptoms as they think they do, then maybe their outcome won't be as successful as they hope for because their expectations were not met.
Because it's always about risk versus benefit. And although the risk may actually be the same, the benefit is different depending on the level of vision they've got.
Well, one of the classic examples is someone with an only eye situation. So the surgical risks will be the same for the general population, but the impact risk of a complication will be huge in that only eye situation. But the irony is then people who are risk adverse will say, well, just leave it as long as possible, keep struggling on. And then the day you actually have to do their cataract surgery, it's going to be far more complex than it would have been decades earlier. So it is a balance.
And of course, we don't want to be referring patients into the hospitalised service or to an independent cataract centre if the patient isn't ready to have surgery or needs to have surgery. So it's about knowing the patient's needs in the community practice to help you decide when is the right time to refer.
Of course, because we have limited capacity. So it's a waste of a slot, if you like, if someone's being referred in for a clinic whenever they're not clear that they want to go ahead for surgery. There may still be occasions where the patient turns up in the eye hospital and following the discussion, other things may be identified or other situations have arisen and they don't wish to proceed. But if someone does not want to go ahead with surgery, it's a waste to send them into a system which is designed to enable them to have their surgery. On that note, however, in Scotland, we still have the ability to have patients referred as urgent or routine. And the difficulty we have with such referrals, if it's not explicit why this patient should be urgent, then it's very hard to prioritise them. Then that difficult concept of can't do their job properly, which means many different things to many different people. But we looked at our urgent cataract referrals and there was quite disappointing low levels of reasoning why people wish to be urgent. And I would just highlight our conclusion, which is if everybody is referred as urgent, then no one can be urgent because the whole system will just run out of capacity. So it's easy to say to a patient, oh yeah, I'll put you down as urgent, I'm the good guy. But it probably makes more sense to say to them, these are the criteria for referral and this is where you fit into that. And having that honest conversation will at least allow them to have an understanding of what will happen to them after the referral has been made. Granted, in different healthcare provision systems, there may be quicker pathways.
Yeah, certainly in England, I don't think there's much in the way of urgent because I think a lot of the larger NHS Trust hospitals don't have the capacity to see people urgently for cataract surgery. So a lot of patients who do want to be treated or operated on sooner tend to be referred to the independent sector. So yes, I think the provision is very different across the UK.
Yeah, I'd agree.
So David, can you briefly talk us through what a cataract surgery would typically entail, just so that we can think about at what point complications may occur?
Sure. So whenever I have a patient in clinic, I will say to them, this is your level of vision, or these are the symptoms you've complained about. Driving at night gives you difficulty with headlights or glare or halos, or often people can't see their golf ball, which is a really big boost we have here in Scotland. I unfortunately can see my golf ball. It's just right in front of me. And so I say to them, if you have a visually significant cataract, we can try to do something to improve your vision. Is that something you'd be interested in? And some people will say, I'm managing totally fine. And you then have this bizarre situation where you're saying to them, your vision is terrible. And they're saying, well, it's fine for me. And that's the sort of patient you don't want to be operating on because you're only going to expose them to risk and no reward because they don't think they've got a visual problem. However, setting those patients aside, the people who have visually significant cataract, I then explain to them that they're going to have to lie flat for 15 minutes. They're going to have their eye covered with a drape. We're going to freeze up their eye. And then through very small incisions, we're going to try to hoover out their cataract and put in an artificial lens.
And at this point, you talk about the risk of surgery, such as those detailed on the Royal College of Ophthalmologists consent form. So, for example, 1 in 100 may need further surgery, and there's 1 in 1,000 risk of a serious complication, such as an infection that might lead to loss of vision or loss of the eye if it's not well managed. So that's why everyone's put on eye drops for a month.
And then after the procedure, your glasses strength will change. And then we allow them to ask additional questions. And that's kind of the sort of mantra of trying to say, this is what we're trying to achieve. This is what could happen. And then, for example, if they've been through courses of intravitreal injections, you might be saying this could become complicated if the back of your lens has been touched by the needle or you're on treatment for your prostate that could affect how your iris behaves in the surgery. Or in my cornea and cataract practice, you have endothelial dystrophy. So we're going to have to put in extra special jellies to protect the cornea. and it might be a bit hazy for a couple of months afterwards, but hopefully it'll settle down. And if it doesn't, you might ultimately need a transplant. So having those types of discussions is all about informed consent, and then the patient knows what they're signing up for. Where you don't go through those things, you end up with a patient who says, why do I have to wear glasses? You know, my friend down the street, she didn't have to wear glasses. You know, that's a very common sort of comparison you hear. And you just have to bite your tongue and say, well, everybody's an individual.
Yes, indeed. We've talked about complications and explaining them to patients. And, you know, we've also mentioned the NOD database as well. So on the summary reports for that, it does talk about evaluating cataract surgery as being successful based on the posterior capsular rupture rate. Why do you think that database focuses on that particular complication?
That's a brilliant question. Posterior capsule rupture has been chosen as a surrogate marker of quality of care. Now, you could argue that's not fair, but that's what it is based on. So what does that mean? That means when we take out the cataract, we leave behind the capsule to support the lens. And if the posterior capsule is ruptured or damaged, it may mean that you have to do an anterior vitrectomy to tidy things up. And you may not be able to use the capsular bag to support your lens, which was intended. And you may have to put it in the sulcus with a different type of lens, or even come back a further day to put in a secondary lens. Research would show that if you have a capsule rupture and vitreous loss, thankfully it happens less than 1% of the time. And it is linked often to the complexity of the patient and also the experience of the operator. But all that said, once you breach the capsule and you then have to remove some of the vitreous, there are significant increased risks of complications, such as an 8 times increased risk of endophthalmitis, a 42 times increased risk of retinal detachment, and 5 to 10% more cystoid macular edema. So it does matter to the patient. Not the fact that you've had a complication per se, but how you dealt with it and how efficiently that has been dealt with. And ironically, because we're becoming all so skilled and our technology is so refined, these situations happen less and less, which may mean that when they happen, the outcomes aren't as good because people aren't as experienced as dealing with it. But I do think the complication rate is here to stay. And it's good to see that risk stratification, appropriate technology, appropriate training has reduced the risk down. Because obviously we should be trying to mitigate as much risk as possible to our patients. Maybe doing some of the more complex ones earlier will help with that. So for a good example is I had a patient the other week who has Parkinson's and is starting to develop quite a significant tremor and shake. And while the vision wasn't terrible, it was still visually significant cataract, and we agreed it would be wiser to get on and do the operation sooner rather than later, because later might be extremely difficult.
Thanks, David. We'll move on to explore the post-operative complications next. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month we explore the topics that matter the most to optometrists like me and you, and that's why we'd like to hear your suggestions for future episodes. So write an email to us. The address is podcast@docket.info. Or you can get in touch with us on X, formerly known as Twitter @soundoptometry. So David, patients are now very commonly seen in the community for their post-operative appointments. Can you talk me through some of the potential post-op, not necessarily complications, but concerns that can occur?
Sure. So I think that's been one of the great developments, but yet problems of modern cataract surgery. It's a great development for the patient. They don't need to go to the eye hospital anymore. They can be seen in the community and they're being seen by the person who's going to provide them ultimately with their glasses. But it's a great hindrance in that none of our junior trainees ever see a routine post-op cataract. So they've no idea what a little bit of inflammation after an eye operation looks like, and everybody is endophthalmitis until proven otherwise. So that can be a bit of an issue. Having said that, it's vital to know the date of surgery because it allows you then to triage appropriately. And just a reminder, the role of an optometrist is triage. And there are 3 R's in triage: reassure, react, or refer. Reassure, you don't need to do anything. Refer, somebody else needs to do something. Or react, I'm able to do something. And then you've got the degrees of priority. So if we start early, in the first 24 hours, if a patient phones up, I'm completely blind in my eye, that's an emergency. They need to be seen. But they might have, rather than it being endophthalmitis, which presents a few days later, they might have TAS, toxic anterior segment syndrome. They might have a decimase membrane detachment. They might have a corneal decompensation. Or they might just be wearing their glasses in front of an eye, which has just had an operation. So again, getting a proper history will give us direction towards what could be the most likely diagnosis and what we're most concerned about. But in the first few days, obviously, endophthalmitis, a blinding eye infection, is what we're most worried about. Thankfully, that is rare due to our use of iodine before the operation, the use of intracameral antibiotic, and also the optometrist's use of treating blepharitis before they get to surgery. I would suggest to you the most common thing we get is the patient at around 10 days to 2 weeks who says, my vision was good to start with and now it's getting worse. And that is the classic time frame for cystoid macular edema. It really shouldn't be missed whenever people say that classic history. The optometrist should be able to do an OCT, see if there's cystoid macular edema, and if they've got independent prescribing, the introduction of a non-steroidal drop alongside the steroid would be a very effective management plan.
Yes. And also the other thing that I'm finding as well in post-op clinics is that we get people referred in for CMO, and actually it's not typical CMO. It looks a little bit asymmetrical, and then you look at the history and they're actually diabetic and you think, is this diabetic macular edema or is it CMO? But in those cases, I tend to behave as if it is CMO until proven otherwise. So I still start a course of treatment. I mean, do you think that's a good idea?
I think we need to do it on a case-by-case basis. I think we need to go back to saying, for some patients, if their cataract has been dense enough, we haven't really had a good assessment of the macula pre-op. So now you've cleared the view, you might see more things. I was about to say it'd be hard to imagine you're going to do much harm. But having said that, if you have someone with rheumatoid hands and the risk of Sjogren's syndrome and the risk of a melting cornea, putting a non-steroidal on top of a preserved steroid and a preserved antibiotic is probably a really bad idea. So I'd want to have much more evidence before I would just treat everyone. But I agree with you, in the sort of atypical CMO situation, it is often my practice to treat it along the same lines as CMO, but still look for further investigations to sort of see if we need to go down the medical retina line or not.
So quite often I will be referring those patients to a medical retina service, but because I know they're not going to be seen within 2 weeks necessarily, I put them on the non-steroidal just in case it's going to help in the meantime while they're waiting referral, and obviously follow that patient up to make sure they do get seen.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And if you look at some of the European studies, that was the standard treatment anyway, that they were putting on non-steroidals post-operatively. But I think you just have to have that question at your back of your mind, am I going to stir up a corneal melt?
And that's why prescribers need to think about other comorbidities and drug interactions before they actually prescribe. So apart from cystoid macular edema, what are the other midterm complications?
So patients can often have inflammation, which is residual. It's not necessarily concerning, but it will show the optometrist that something has happened. So for example, if you knew an operation was slightly more complex, but not necessarily complicated, it shouldn't surprise you that an eye might be slightly more inflamed, that the patient might have ran out of their steroid drops, that there might be some cells in the anterior chamber. But you know there's no vitritis, you know the vision's good, you know there's no hypopyon. We're not concerned about an endophthalmitis presenting at 3 or 4 weeks post-operative. And it's entirely appropriate to use the steroid drops for a bit longer. And on occasion, I might have someone on treatment in their normal post-op routine 4 times a day for a month. They get seen for a particular reason, and you maybe then tail it down, reducing by a drop per week over the next 4 weeks. That's quite common. If their pressure has gone up, well, how do you know it's gone up if it hasn't actually been measured preoperatively, which is another bone of contention? So if you have a pressure which was normal and is now raised, and you're assuming that there isn't viscoelastic left around inside the eye, for example, viscoat for the soft shell technique, or if you're assuming that it's due to the steroid drops, well, if there's no inflammation, stopping the steroids will be sufficient. or switching to a non-steroidal, you don't always need to put someone on a drop to treat a drop, like pressure drops, and then how are you going to make a decision when to stop that? But I think it's a case-by-case basis, and it's assessing what's the risk of treatment versus the benefit of treatment.
We've spoken about the short and the sort of mid-term complications. What about the more long-term ones? So thinking about sort of vision in general, patients quite often find after they've had their cataract surgery, they want to get back to their normal activities, driving, working and so on. So what typically do patients complain about or have concerns about with their vision?
So there's two things there. And the first thing I'm going to comment on is capture pacification, and the newer lens designs have reduced the incidence of that with their square edges. But unless you live in a culture and a climate where you're doing primary posterior capsulotomies at the time of surgery and you come across a fibrotic scarred bit of capsule, it is often the case that it's not a complication, but the surgeon may leave it and plan to do a YAG capsulotomy a few months later, which is probably a safer way to deal with it. And I have to object when that's used as a measure in outcomes, because it was intended to be left because it's safer to do it that way around. So again, reassuring a patient in that scenario. And I'm always amazed when you think, oh, there's this fibrotic plaque there, I'm going to leave it. I've explained to the patient that we might need to do a laser at a later stage, which would be much safer. And then their vision's excellent. And yet you're looking and thinking, how can it be excellent whenever it looks like that? But they are happy to leave it. And explaining to them that it's not the cataract growing back, it's the supportive membrane frosting up, I think is a very useful and reassuring thing for them. But you touched on probably what is the most difficult question I have to answer, which is when a patient says to me, when can I drive again? The legal position is clearly the 20 metres, but there will be an adjustment period for patients who may be anisometropic, maybe putting in drops frequently, maybe a bit photosensitive. And thankfully for the vast majority of people, they're sensible and they understand that. But I'd be intrigued to hear what your position is, because it's a conversation we have all the time and it always feels very unsatisfactory when you can't give them a clear answer.
So when I get asked that, or quite often I do actually ask patients if they drive, and I do say, explain that you can drive after you've had your cataract surgery, but not straight away. So I would give it a week or so. And then check the number plate yourself, make sure you can see it from 20 metres away, and make sure that you don't have double vision. And I said, if you're in any doubt, go back to your optometrist and ask them to do a vision check, but don't necessarily get new glasses yet unless you really need those glasses to drive and you need to be able to drive before your eyes completely settle down. And that's the other variable as well, isn't it, David? Because some optometrists are quite happy to refract and prescribe glasses earlier if a patient needs to drive. But most optometrists would prefer to wait a little bit longer, maybe 4 weeks, 6 weeks, until everything's more settled and their refraction is less likely to change.
Yeah, I can see it from both sides. The patient wants to just get on with their life. And I often get this with sports people or fitness addicts who say, oh, can I get back to doing my extreme sports? And what I try to say to them is, I'm not here to wreck your life. But if you could take it easy for a couple of weeks, then you can enjoy your vision for the rest of your life rather than you do something and you regret it. And I know that's maybe a cop-out position, but it's incredible how people almost think, you know, have a cataract surgery straight back into all contact sports.
Well, it's going back to setting patient expectations again, isn't it, at the very beginning at the community level, because I do get lots of patients who pause when I say there's no heavy lifting or bending for 4 weeks after the surgery, and they look at me with a raised eyebrow and I say, so if you're playing golf, no bending over to pick up your golf ball, or if it's someone who enjoys fitness, I say no standing on your head to do your yoga positions, and then they ask me, well, what can I do?
Yeah, because that's the only activity. Stand on your head's the only thing you can do for fitness. Absolutely. It's very strange to have these conversations. And I think it's best to just say to them, be pragmatic, because no one's divided two groups in two and got half them to stand on their head, half them not to, and see who had a globe rupture at the end of it. But it's just common sense. Where I feel it is less the exercise person, it's the person who is a carer for a family member. And you're saying to them, I understand you have to have your cataract surgery as soon as possible because you're the only driver, you're the only carer, you've all these responsibilities. But having said that, you're entitled to respite care. If someone could help you out for a couple of weeks, then you'll be able to continue to be a carer. But if you give yourself an infection through rubbing your eye or doing something untoward, then we're all going to regret this. And that's sometimes the story they don't want to hear, but they need to hear.
Yes, yes. So, David, what are your top tips for communicating with patients when you need to inform them about the potential for complications without scaring them?
Yeah, I said earlier how I explain the consent process, and it's kind of going through the highs, but just be careful so that you're saying it in a balanced way. It's trying to, in a very polite way, say, this is what the population statistics are, but you're not a population, you're an individual. And this is the impact on you as an individual, and only you can decide. Because often you'll hear this, oh, I'll do whatever you want. Do you think my eyes are bad enough? I'm not the one looking through them. You need to tell me how your deterioration of vision is affecting your life. And it's not that you need to convince me to operate on you, but you need to convince yourself that it's worth the risks. And so I think that is my best advice, that we would communicate clearly and in a balanced way, and the patient feels part of the decision-making process. We're treating patients here and people. We're not just treating eyeballs and cataracts. And so if the patient understands what the benefit is for them, then I think they can make a reasonable assessment of the risks involved, because we're all very bad at assessing risk for ourselves. So it's trying to get that context where they can make a balanced decision.
Yes. How do you think the optometry profession as a whole can evolve and make an even greater contribution to the patient journey, make it better if they can?
I think they do a very good job. I think communication is the key to anything. So I think referral refinement would be helpful. Certainly identifying the appropriate patient earlier would be helpful. I think having the pre-op conversation about the outcomes and the targets will help make the hospital experience more refined. And I think the danger is that we've had this conveyor belt system of referral into an eye hospital and no one can get out, whereas it needs to be more of a revolving door where optometrists are doing the primary examinations, patients are coming into the hospital eye system and then are rotating back out with protocol driven guidelines and a way to get back in if necessary. So I suppose the question is, are optometrists making the best use of their skills? They certainly have a lot of equipment, but are they using that equipment wisely? And are they using their referrals when they need to be used, as opposed to it's a way just to move this patient along?
And it goes back to triage again, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You're trying to make me say these R words, which I can't say properly with my accent. But yeah, reassure, react, refer. That is the most important part of all our jobs. And then you can do the right thing.
Thank you very much, David.
Thanks for having me.
Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and clinical practice. We'll be back again next month to look at advanced optometric roles. We'll be exploring the treatment of posterior capsular opacification that we discussed in this episode, and we'll also be speaking to optometrists about their experience in treating patients with a YAG laser for PCO and other eye conditions. So make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss that. That's all from us. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.